This is D's Practice Pod. Today, we're going to talk to an old friend. I met this fella. We used to teach for the same school, the Long Island Drum School. His name is Marko Djordjevic, and he's just an unbelievable drummer. It was always a treat to have a student not show up so I could listen to him practicing. Hard-working guy. I guess this is the best time to introduce him now because I have a bajillion questions that I probably already know the answer to, but, you know, I'm leading just a little bit. Okay, so...
here we go. Wow, that was a very sweet introduction.
Oh, thank you.
Appreciate it.
So, Marko, when I first met you, I was listening. I was actually in my teaching room, and I'm hearing somebody play in the next room, or what I thought was actually two people playing in the next room. And it was not. It was you solo in there. And, well, you have a... probably the, yeah, okay, but if you are actually able to get from, you know, there is a show on TV called The Flash now, he could probably play two sets at one time, but you were just playing the hell out of the one that you were behind. You have possibly the most unique approach to our instrument ever, and I can tell you... It really surprised me because, you know, when you've been playing for a very long time, you have some predisposed idea on how good you are, and you know how much of a grasp you have on your instrument, and to hear someone play it, well, not just play what I'm playing, but play something just completely different, it's very eye-opening, and I think that's one of the things I like about our instrument the most is. Just when you think you learned it all, you heard somebody that has such a completely different way of looking at things that you realize you still have a lot more to go.
I hear you. I mean, what I would add to that is that I think, you know, when we're kids and we are trying to get our instrument to sound good and, you know, trying to make music on it, I think we also have this idea that eventually, you know, if you practice hard enough and get into the right sorts of situations and be led by or guided by the right people, you may get to the point where you've conquered it all.
Yes. There's somewhere over the rainbow.
Exactly. Yeah, eventually, you know, you find out that that's not exactly how things work, but I think there are two aspects of, you know, along the same line of thought that can play into this. One is you never lose that desire, no matter how impossible it is to actually reach that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And then once you actually can marry that desire to get to it all with the realization that you actually will not, because it's just not possible, you come to a point where everything, at least that's how it's been for me, where everything just becomes a serene road on which you keep making your attempt, but with, you know, much less frustration and much less angst and antsiness and much more in a peaceful, productive manner. And also it bodes well for the creativity as well, because when you remove the shackles of an unreasonable desire, you end up with what your heart really truly wants to do, which is just sit there and play drums and make music, you know, and that's really worked well for me.
Well, I could not possibly have put that better than that. And since we've gotten to whatever point we're at now, why don't we roll back the clock a little bit? How did you first get into drumming? I should tell everyone first that Marco has probably a better grasp of the English language than I do, but he's not from the United States. Why don't you tell everybody where you're from originally?
I'm from Serbia originally. I was born in Belgrade in 1972. And essentially, as far as my musical development goes, I tried other instruments before, drums, and but I always really wanted to play the drums. I played the guitar. That really didn't go well at all. I didn't have a knack for that. I played the trumpet for a year. That went really well.
Yeah, that could be confusing. Was it spelled the same way?
What's that?
Was his name spelled the same way?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And plus his sister's first name was Maya, just like my sister's name. So
wow, really that's...
He's coincidence. And we went to the same elementary school. We were classmates in the elementary school, and then we, the recruiting people from the music school came to our elementary school, and they said that the two of us would do well in trumpets, so we signed up and went, and I lasted a year, he lasted a lifetime.
Well, that's just where his passion lies then.
Not long thereafter, I found an ad about who was to become my first and to this day the best teacher, coming back from the Jazz Academy in Graz. He was the first graduate. That was basically a classical school, and they just had opened the jazz department, and he was the first drummer actually to graduate from the jazz department of that school, and he came back from Austria and was starting to give lessons. So I found that ad in the paper and told my mom that this is something that I wanted to do, and so my mom signed me up, and I went, and it was just great. Because I learned the right way from the start. I mean, I still go take lessons with him when I go back home.
What did you say his name was again?
Miroslav Karlovic.
Wow.
Miroslav Karlovic, like Carlo. I mean, that was actually his nickname. Everybody called him Carlo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, wow. So, yeah, and before that, even while I was trying the guitar or practicing the trumpet, I would, just bang around on my mom's detergent boxes, they were round, like big tubs.
Right, right.
They made pretty good drums, actually.
Wow.
So I would just rock out on those and, just do whatever I could to try to figure it out and get as close to it without having a kit as possible.
Well, I think you did a bang-up job of it.
Oh, yeah.
Bang-up job. Hey, great.
Intended, yeah.
But your education didn't stop there. Firstly, did you have aspirations to come to the States first, or did college just call you there and it happened to be where it was?
That's basically what happened. I mean, by Berkeley being such, even at that point, I mean, now obviously they're just a humongous machine and that has done very successful marketing the world over. And at that point, it was a little more word of mouth, but still there were, their presence in Europe was very strong. There was even like a mystique about it and all this stuff. And so I ended up applying to Berkeley, and that was the advice that Carlo gave me too. And then, that's really how it happened. I would have ended up anywhere where people who meant well, and had my interest in mind would have told me, and this seemed to be him and this American drummer, David Moss, who came to Serbia to play with this great guitar player over there and learned Serbian and spent a lot of time living there. He also suggested well, it's very beneficial and very productive.
Yeah, that was my question, because I've talked to a lot of people who went to Berkeley, some of which had very good experiences, and some of which it was the bane of their existence.
Understood, yeah.
So it must be a very challenging program.
That depends. I mean, from having been there as a student, now being there as a teacher, I mean, I get how, it could be the two extremes, but it really has to do with basically the ideas, designs, and goals that you set out, for yourself before ever getting there. I think, not to say that things can't change while you're there. In fact, they probably sure. do for a lot of people. But I think people go in with expectations and ways that they think things were gonna, would work. And I think, generally speaking, the ones who have a negative experience are the ones who set up either expectations that were not realistic or had some misapprehensions about, how to move towards your goals in music. Also, I shouldn't neglect to point out that Berkeley is a huge school. So in a way, I view it as a really good, people always talk in college how eventually you'll get to that real life, and the college existence is slightly shielded and not grounded in reality. I feel like Berkeley actually really is. It's so huge, and you can see so much from the most talented people you can think of to people who really shouldn't be considering music at all. And as well with the teachers, like some of the greatest teachers that you could ever find, some of the greatest musicians, and then some people that are really, average or below average.
Right.
So it runs the gamut. And for a person who kind of has a realistic idea about life, I suppose, I think Berkeley's a great place to be, because that's exactly what you're going to find there, is like real life.
Right. So you feel also that they're sort of in tune, pun again, with the music industry and that sort of thing.
I definitely, to be honest, that aspect of it is not my favorite. I believe that they're currently in tune to a fault. In other words, there are things that I really, I'm sure you can relate. There are things that I really dislike about the music industry that I think they are getting into because, for commercial reasons.
Well, yeah. I'm sure some of it is pure survival. But also probably situations that they brought on themselves to begin with. Right.
Creating, songs to be hits and, having a major that's, that when I was there, there was film scoring. Now there is a separate major dealing with video game music.
Right. Yeah.
Again,
yeah.
Really does reflect the way things are. I mean, there's a lot of music being written for video games, but.
Well, sure. Video games are proving to be more profitable than movies. Yeah. Yes.
So it's hard to, it is what it is, I guess.
Yeah.
But definitely, like I said, having been
You know,
on that level.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
I mean, so definitely, you know, there's definitely more than just a speck of light. There's considerable light to it, Berkeley.
Yeah, I mean, there are those who will argue that this coming generation is one of the most softest.
I think that's really a good word. And I know exactly.
Entitled is another good one. I wouldn't say that they're necessarily wrong, but I would say that maybe it's you shouldn't view them there as a clear sweep. The kids that do have their nose to the grindstone have it deeper into the grindstone than anybody I've ever seen. You know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, in some ways, it may also be working in contrast to.
Well, so there might be a little bit of guilt for the rest of their generation.
You get surprised when somebody even comes near the grind.
Yeah. Speaking as a fellow educator, I'm in the private sector, but when also we spoke of the movies. Did you see the movie Whiplash?
Yes, indeed, I have, and actually, on the urging of a student who's a very good friend. I mean, he's a bit older than both of us, and he's a great guy, kind of an interesting person because he does a lot of different stuff. I mean, he's an architect, so that's his. You know, that's what he does, but he also has like a shop in which he does like artisan woodwork.
Right.
And he also has a great love for music, so he's been, you know, at the drums for a very long time and has developed, you know, a very, very commendable ability on our instrument. You know, and anyways, mm-hmm. He saw it, and I, like I said, through the lessons, we actually have become, you know, we've become really good friends.
Right.
And, so he asked me to watch it because he'd just seen it, and I did watch it after that. And was there a specific question about that, or would you want me to?
Well, yeah, I did. Well, that was just to open up the door to it. But did much like most movies that are based on music. There's usually not a whole lot of playing being done by the actors themselves. That being said, though, what did you feel? I'll play devil's advocate and say this kid played everything. What did you feel about the, did you find it realistic, particularly the approach and expectations of the main professor? Drive the story.
It's a typical hero story.
Right.
You know, you get the calling, then you know there are obstacles, then you overcome them, and there's, you know, the dark, kind of like the light, dark light figure, the Darth Vader kind of
yes.
character in the
right. Yes.
He had to, the bus, you know, so there were so many unrealistic things about him getting on the bus by himself to go to this band competition. I would imagine that 99 times out of 100, the band would go there together in a chartered bus.
I would think so, yeah.
Comes along. That's
right.
When I started laughing. And
yeah.
That's where the movie, you know, if there was any shred of credibility that the movie had with me, it lost it right there when the 18-wheeler was the metaphor for another hard knock.
Right. Well, that's where it went from being basically a hero picture to a superhero picture. Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that that we discussed, you know, my student and I, and or I should really say my friend and I, because at that point, I mean, you know, obviously, like I said, I've known him for a while. We've been doing
right.
This.
Right.
We've developed a friendship beyond student teacher, you know, and we discussed that, and in some ways, that you know, that sentence does resonate, you know, and I think it goes along with what you've said as the assessment of the generation as being softer, you know, and then I think good job is a way of appeasing the softy.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't have a problem with it if good job is actually warranted. I feel it's pretty overused.
Absolutely, and I think that.
Right. Yeah.
To denote the times when it's used without merit. You know?
Right. Right. Well, just to put this particular thing to bed, my biggest contention that I had was actually more of a technical issue.
I skipped that altogether. Maybe that was the wrong.
Oh, okay. Well, they were practicing Caravan, and. They had all of the drummers going back and forth, seeing who could do it at the proper speed, and how meticulous the conductor was being about what the exact speed was. And that being said, you know, I'm sure that there are guys that are that much of a hard ass, but to have these guys trying harder and harder and harder and harder to play this thing at that speed. Trying harder and harder and harder makes it impossible to play it at that speed. I mean, it's just the basic physics of what it is that we do. As soon as you tighten up, you're going to slow down.
Most definitely.
You know? So that I think, you know, but obviously to push the story along, that's the reason why they had to do it. But all drummers who have tried to do it that way have failed every, you know, 100%. But... Yes.
Putting his hands into ice.
Yeah.
I mean, for crying out loud, you know that. But I feel like, you know, when I honestly reassess my view of the drum set when I was a child,
right.
And of what it took, I also thought that that it took that kind of you know, brute physical force and strength and endurance to play. Play that instrument, you know. I didn't know any better.
Right.
So I think this is, and now I can kind of tie it in to an infantile, or at least to an audience that you consider to be infantile, because you're playing to the lowest common denominator.
Mm-hmm.
You present an infantile view of something like drumming, or it could be anything else.
Well, you know, yeah.
Imagine for us who know a little bit about this topic. Being it portrayed in a way that's quite at odds with what the reality is. Just imagine, you know, there was a great years is usually wrong. So what am I to think about all this other stuff that, you know, because no human can know everything, what am I to think of all this other shit that is being sold to us that we have no idea about?
Well, sure, you know, right.
And that's yeah. kind of how we view the movie itself. So they just kind of, you know, threw it in, tried, and,
yeah.
and I guess, you know, they made a movie.
Yeah. Well, it was pretty entertaining, but it was in fact fiction, and I guess we'll just leave that there. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we've gotten from the past. What's going on in the present? Well, you've always been busy.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, you know, playing-wise, it has been very good. And, you know, right along with that goes the fact that I'm practicing as much as I can. I also have my own group, which some of the stuff that's going to be happening on the road is going to be with four or five different projects, but among them also parts of this will be with my own group, which is a group that I write all the music for.
It's Sveti.
In the lineup, it's the great bass player, Evan Marion, and no less great, Julian Pollack on piano and keys. And so it's a really rewarding experience playing with the two of them. We're getting ready to do a new album in the fall. I have four albums so far.
You are referring to Sveti, right? I'd say so.
That would be, and I guess looking into the very close future after the road this summer, some drummy things. I've been invited to play at both PASIC and the London Drum Show, which will happen literally. You know, they'll be 3 days apart, so because they schedule them in the same week, which is slightly surprising. You would think that major events like that would be a little bit more coordinated in that sense.
Right, so that they wouldn't be competing directly against each other for the same audience, yeah.
The partisan.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, you know, lucky for me, it'll work out and I'll be playing at both, which is it's really nice.
Oh, so they didn't have a Letterman-Leno thing where you play at one and don't play at the other?
Yeah,
well, of course, yeah, they have to have their agenda.
Do it in
Right, right. So essentially a big jam session with guys who are super accomplished.
I would say that that's probably a good assessment, yeah. Okay. I mean, I'm starting to notice that, you know, now we've really played probably 20 shows in about a year and a half, so it's not that much, but, you know, it's roughly a show a month. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, and obviously some months it's a little bit busier, some months when I'm away, or they also tour a great deal, so we're not always in town at the same time. But the point is, I've also noticed that there are certain things that after playing for that long, and plus, I mean, I've been playing with Matt for a really long time, ever since Berkeley, and we all went to Berkeley at the same time. I didn't really meet Ole until a little bit later in terms of, I mean, I met him over there, but we didn't play and musically meet him until sometime later in New York, but you know, we know each other pretty well, and now that we've played in this format, I feel like, you know, there are certain places that we gravitate towards or that we tend to go to, so I think now that the challenge is to not do that to a point where it becomes obvious, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
It has to, I think the magic of it is when some magic happens, you know, and that's usually something unexpected.
Right, so, right.
The intention is to try to keep that open aspect and reach for spots that are beyond the comfort zone, at least for, you know, not necessarily like in every second of every performance, but
right.
To have that not ever become lost on us, you know.
But that's how we advance performance, you know.
Definitely.
So. Okay. And actually a little bit into the future as well. I have a question from a former student. By the way, you did mention a student of mine, Sean Butani, who I did mix up two names and faces. he wasn't a little boy. I saw him probably only a few months ago, and he's a really nice guy.
Yeah.
Good player.
And talented. Yeah.
Yeah. But I kind of hipped him to you.
That's what, you know? I heard. I mean, he told me that you know. But then when you said that it was so long ago, then I was like.
Yeah, it's a different. Yeah, it's a. I was thinking of another gentleman. Yeah. But one thing that I do use YouTube a bit in my studio because I do believe that I don't know everything. So sometimes someone says something or demonstrates something that is so perfect that. If I already know that someone else has done it in a way that will, you know, get so much clarity, then I'm just going to use their version of it. And there's a few videos of yours that I do use, and one of them is your development of the single stroke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the first time he saw you. And then I did play some of the Sveti stuff that I have of yours, and. You know, and there's a number of students, my more accomplished guys, that I do like to show them music other than what they hear on the radio, because, you know, that's usually the most watered down version of what it is that we do.
Understood.
You know, so.
Yeah, I agree. Well, that's totally cool, because, I mean, like I said, he did mention it, and it's just. Oh, the only reason why I didn't mention it is because when we talked about it, like you said, now
I can't believe I did that.
You missed file for a second.
Yeah, well, the reason why is because I'm doing my summer push to try to get, so I'm going through Rolodex of old guys who've been to college and such, you know, to try to reinvigorate the relationship. And, you know, sometimes you just mix those names and faces up, but what are you going to do? But I don't know how I did it either. I mean, I've had him on and off for a very long time, and
right.
You know, I have seen him go from a high school kid into, you know, beyond
man.
Being college and being a man, you know. So it's been a while. No, no, I was thinking of another fella, and now I can't bring his name to the front of my brain. So I guess there's a finite amount of space up there.
How many students do you have? Like when it's really busy, how many students is that for you?
I've topped off at about 33. Right now I have about 18. I did kind of let things lapse a little bit because, you know, it is very cyclical. I teach a lot of kids. So, you know, you lose them to college and then you have to replenish. But I had to build my own studio, and it is such a Herculean endeavor to do. I just needed all that time to build, you know, so I did let it shrink out of necessity, you know, but now it's not always the easiest thing to bolster it back up again. But well, I'm doing okay. What about you? Well, you know, do you teach privately? Is
obviously a whole lot. 18 is still pretty.
It's significant, you know. It that's not enough to keep me out of a day job, though.
Understood.
You know, and I'd really rather be doing music exclusively.
Yeah.
But it's tall order. You know, it's a real trek to try to do that. Speaking of which, you have managers, or how do you get gigs?
No, I mean, I don't know. I don't have anybody that's a manager. I, you know, for the last album, I hired a publicist and a radio promo person. I am talking currently to this agent in Europe that I'm hoping we come to a place where we're actually working together. He's pretty well connected, and that's really, more than anything else, that's what I need, because my primary goal, musically speaking, these days, even though I love playing with different people, there's no question about that, but I mean, yeah, and I obviously take gigs that I think are worth my time musically and all that, but I, you know, my band is my band, you know. And,
right, right.
What I really need is to step up the booking game with that, and we've had some pretty good success, like booking gigs around town or being able to go on short road trips, like we did a 10-day tour on the West Coast last year, a year and a half ago now, on, you know, stuff around New York's been good. Every so often we get some travel stuff, like we're going to get this summer. But it would be really nice. What I'm aiming for is like around, what would be great is like between 20 and 30 really meaningful international gigs a year. So not like a crazy, you know, 100, 200, whatever, you know, I'm not really even interested in that. What would be great is to have a few really nice tours and then play, you know, in town a couple of times a month. And that would be good. You know, that would be around, all told, like 25 to 30 gigs touring and then another, realistically, about 20 gigs in town a year, 20, 25, so just a couple of times a month. Playing town, you know, that would be 50 gigs with my band, and I would be very, very happy if that materialized, you know. But for that I can't do alone. Or if I did alone, I mean, it would literally be all I could do. You know what I mean? Like it would mean a Herculean effort, like you said,
right.
on the booking front. You know?
Right, right.
Nearly impossible.
Well, you know, in order to continue to advance as a player, it's kind of hard to take that time away from that. I'm speaking from personal experience.
Definitely.
Yeah, it just there's only so many hours in a day, and I think your time is much more well spent practicing and hoping that the people that are around you are going to treat you properly and you know.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, the other side of it, I remember talking when I just moved to New York. You know, when I met Wayne Krantz and we started talking, and I remember, you know, I think things are. So this is 20 years ago, basically 97, so just short of 20 years.
Right.
And you know, he was doing all the playing in the 55 and stuff like that, doing some touring, but it was literally, you know, when he booked a tour and he was really saying how that's all he was able to do for 2 months, you know, just getting the contacts and, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
Doing all this stuff that literally put him off music, essentially, in order to be able to play.
Right. The catch 22.
In today's world, I mean, it's hard, even, you know, even at the high, maybe not at the very highest level, obviously, with people who are names for a long time, but certainly in terms of musicianship, at the highest level, you have people who are having to do their own legwork, or at least a good portion of it, you know, which it's just an unfortunate reality.
Yeah. Exactly, as opposed to now.
Right. Bringing the people in, you know?
Right. Well, years ago, I mean, at 1 o'clock in the morning, there would be people coming into a club, not even knowing who was going to be playing. They went there because it was the club, and you must know your onions if you got a gig there. Now it's the opposite. The clubs are really just real estate ventures that are open, and they want us to do all of the footwork and all of the promotion and spend all the money and
yeah.
You know, I'm glad to hear that. I'm not glad to hear that you're experiencing the same kind of
no,
thing.
But
I
feel the same way. You know, we're,
I empathize. Let's put it that way.
I am that. But, I mean, it's been going on for quite a while now.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's picked up speed with places like, let's say, Loaded, or ones like that, which claim to be promotional concerns, but really they're really printing companies.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So.
Right.
To all and blah, 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 and sharing the burden of getting the people in and all that. So, yeah, it's probably a bit of a tougher world.
Yeah.
In that sense than it used to be, but you know, it is what it is.
It is what it is.
Yeah. Okay. And we do our best.
Well, I wouldn't. This is sort of also how the world sort of breeds mediocrity. A guy at your playing level should be a household name, but well, that's the world we live in. Well, it's a boutique thing. It pretty much always has been. It always goes back to pop, whatever pop is at the moment.
But I think, you know, either pop used to be better, which definitely there is, I think, some merit to that argument, because if you consider that pop used to be, in some ways, jazz even...
Yeah.
Even at the point of like going between 50s and the 60s, when things started getting pretty open and bebop was already Hendrix was popular. Bands like Mahavishnu and Weather Report were
yeah.
pretty popular.
Well, you can make the argument that Beethoven was pop music at one point.
Well, yeah.
Right?
There's that as well, right?
Right,
so,
right.
Well, I was in Barcelona and after a gig and in a cab, and that was the first time I ever heard that song. And I just thought, like, man, we've stooped to new lows.
Well, you know, she's a smart girl. She went to NYU, but it was not for music. It was for marketing. You think she did her job?
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
You know, so. I'm sure there's a machine.
Sure.
You know,
sure. The thing is, too, that she's very talented also. I mean, if you've heard some of the other things that she's done that aren't pop, you know, she's got some, you know, she's got some chops. It's just, you know,
I didn't even know because I think I probably heard that song and I heard anything else.
Right.
Yeah,
well, yeah, that's cut. Yeah, that's the same basic. Yeah, but she, you know, she did some stuff with Tony Bennett, and you know, she can sing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't doubt it. It's just that you know, when you do a song like Alejandro,
yeah,
that to me kind of ends you.
Yeah, well, there's not a lot for us to chew on with that either, and you know that yeah, always will.
It's the vacuity of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's just nothing there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's because I don't know whether I guess it's from whatever perspective you take, but it could either be an evolution or a devolution. But if you think about it, we went from just music to then the music business to now the music industry.
Mm-hmm.
So. You got to churn this stuff out, and now at a way lower profit margin than you were making before, because now the minute that you put it out there, somebody puts it online and it just gets stolen anyway. So how much effort should you put into this to just to throw it out there to not make any money, you know? And if that was your original intention is to make money, then you're going to do as little as possible to make that money. If you're really an artist like yourself, you're going to be a little bit more content with less money, but you can sleep at night because you know that you did something that actually is worth it.
Yeah, so, you know, and I like that evolution-devolution thing because as much as it applies to what you said about, you know, it being music, business, music, industry, you know, how did we get to a state of affairs where, you know, something that used to be the music of the day also used to be fairly good music or great music or really interesting music or whatever it happens to be. I mean, I'm sure there was crap.
Mm-hmm.
Always, you know, as well. But, you know, if we look at, you know, literally and justly at what used to be called popular music at, I don't know, in the 20s and the 30s. And,
right.
You know, and look at what is popular music now, right? It's impossible not to see the difference in quality.
Well, you know, I think,
you know, what went into it.
I have a little theory about that. Whatever became popular back in the day, be it from Beethoven all the way through, it always seemed to be that we gravitated towards things that were going against the grain. And that's what made it popular, and because it was different, you know? And now it just seems that everything's just trying to play it so safe that there's nothing new in it, nothing original in it, nothing really even creative about it. As a matter of fact, you listen to a lot of songs now, you could place one right on top of the other one and play them simultaneously.
Really cookie cutter type.
Yeah, yeah. That's, I think that's the biggest problem. Yes.
In some ways, it sounds bad to say because, you know, who are you to stop anybody from trying their hand at anything, you know? But
well, sure.
What ends up happening is, you know, people try to cut corners and there's probably a lack of respect for what it actually, or a lack of understanding and then a lack of respect for what it takes to actually become someone that can really make music.
Well, it's gone from being art to being product. And I mean, you can make the argument that it always has been that way, but now the divide between it is just so vast that there's no way that you can call a lot of it even art.
Yeah, or you know? Music. For that matter. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. I.
That's kind of where I'm at with these things. And as for, you know, what you said about the originality, I think that's where I was headed, really, with that point about not to begrudge anybody the ability to try to, like I said, try their hand at playing music or anything like
right.
that.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
What's left is a lot of people with very limited means attempting to do what's been done before.
Right. Well, also the fact that people are desperate to stay out there. I mean, when you have people that become instant successes from winning a talent show on television, what are you going to expect if that's what your society has brought us to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean...
Mm-hmm.
Our attention spans have been shortened.
Oh my God! I mean,
you know, just technology's done that. When we were kids, you put an album on, you put the needle down, you laid on your bed, and you read the album cover. Now, if you get even slightly bored after about 5 seconds, flick next song. You know, and you know, it's a tough nut when that's what you're up against.
Most definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's that. There's also the incredible loss of perspective when things are on shuffle. You know what I mean?
In yes.
You could ask a kid that even listens to some music to tell you the periods, you know, of even a band whose music they like by hearing something from this period, something like that. But
right.
They wouldn't be able to tell you if something
no.
was from the 70s or from the mid-80s.
No.
The output of the same band. Like, they wouldn't have the perspective or the frame of reference to differentiate between, I don't know, David Bowie from, you know, 80-something and David Bowie from 1998.
Oh, yeah, or even think of a band with a way shorter lifespan. Take the Beatles, for example. You take their first songs when they first landed in the United States, and then you take the last two albums that they had. That was a completely different band. But when these kids, firstly, I've seen comments on like iTunes, overrated. That had to be a 13-year-old who heard one song. You know, they didn't really. You didn't see the journey. You didn't see the evolution. You didn't, you know, but for exactly what it is that you were saying, because their, you know, their involvement in it is so selective. Yeah. Right.
With time, especially in Europe, it, you know, the, I guess it was from the Middle Ages and then especially Renaissance and beyond, the traveling minstrel, you know, that already started adding an element of, you know, here's a man who's traveling around singing his songs. You're the audience. He's the songsmith. You know, and I think that's where also, you know, well, another thing about the music initially was that there was no divide between audience and those who create music, because usually they were one and the same.
Sure.
You know, and so eventually it got to this predicament in which it is a, you know, it's a very separate thing. The audience is the audience, the you know, the singer, artist, whatever you want to call the, you know, the musician is separate and elevated, you know what I mean? Like a,
right. Yes.
You know, where everybody would be centered around or gravitating towards, you know, the effort gravitating towards either, like I said, paying respect to a god or to nature or a particular aspect of life. Now it's the, you know, music has become its own thing, which is pretty remarkable. And then there's these people who play it who are being put on a pedestal of some sort. Now, I maintain that, in a lot of ways, that isn't necessarily a good thing, and what I think, especially in improvised music, you know, when it comes to it is more obscure and takes a little bit more to get into, there is a point at which when the performance is really good and the people in the audience are honestly digging it, that I, at least, and this is my experience, where I start feeling the negation of that intermediary space, and I start realizing that all of a sudden, or, you know, in the process, we're coming full circle to this idea of no boundaries between the performer and the audience, like having a communal experience that's beyond, like, you know, full circle back to the idea of it actually all coming from a different place and all of us sitting there in awe, regardless of whether we happen to be performing or listening,
right.
But just, you know, having this sense of a shared moment in which we realize that there is, you know, that music is just a metaphor for something mysterious and considerably greater than us.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you know what? I couldn't have said it better myself.
Connect to, you know, using music as a vehicle to connect to some things that
Well, that's why we have music.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's why it's there.
That's it.
And the lovely thing it is.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, we're about to run out of CD.
Understood.
So I'll just, we'll say that I'd like to invite you at a later date, maybe to actually come to my studio. This podcast I have great aspirations for. I would like to eventually make it not only audio but a video podcast as well. You know, and that would be, you know, it could all be like impromptu clinic or what have you. And, you know, then really start digging
it'll
into.
It would be a lot of fun to do all of this and actually play as well.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so let me just say, this has been Marko Djordjevic, and this has been D's Practice Pad.
Yay.
Okay. I'm just going to hit stop and then we'll continue our conversation.
Sounds good, yeah. Oh, that was fun.
Well, and...